This oral history compilation tape on the construction of the Glazewell Bridge was produced from original interviews conducted by Frank Hymans and Martha and Sarah. The project was commissioned by the RTA Environment and Community Policy Branch in December 2000. The opinions in the oral history interview tapes are those of the individuals concerned and do not necessarily represent in whole or in part the position of the New South Wales Roads and Traffic Authority.
The Glazewell Bridge, I still see it as something quite wonderful, really. It's a very beautiful bridge. It certainly is a major impact on the landscape, but either you have a major impact or you don't. It's, it's definitely a statement. There's no question about its integrity as a fine civil engineering structure. It certainly tells us about some very grand visions for Sydney and about a whole era of post-war planning and an approach to the engineering works which were part of that planning. That certainly makes a statement in that way. It tells us something about the period and the way things were viewed at that time.
The Glazewell Bridge is undoubtedly a major Sydney Harbour landmark, and many people were involved with its planning, design and construction. Ray Wedgwood, now General Manager Technical Services at RTA, was involved with the bridge from early in its construction.
Sydney is a unique city with its topography in terms of the harbour particularly, and even other waterways that need to be crossed. If you go back in time, originally they were crossed by boat and then for people, and then barges and punts for cars. And all the time there's been that, as with any city, that growth, that development, that need to improve the ability of people's mobility. Glazewell Bridge was very much the linchpin of north, south, east, west axis of the city at the time it was designed and built. That axis has probably moved westward now in terms of where people want to go to get from A to B is related to where they live, where they work.
Sandy McKenzie was the Department of Main Roads' resident engineer on the Glazewell Bridge.
Before the first Glazewell Bridge was built, there was a ferry between Abbotsford and Gladesville. It would have been hauled by a rope, as rope ferries are still done today.
Laurie Stewart was a surveyor for the Department of Main Roads. He remembers the very first bridge at Gladesville.
It was a structure built, I think, in the 1880s. It was two lanes only, that is, one lane in each direction it was meant to be. It had a tramway across it. When the tram went across, of course, the cars and trucks had to go behind it. There wasn't room beside. There was no pedestrian footway, whatever. The public could travel free of charge on the tram and then when they were finished on the bus to get across the bridge. Police officers would be there at the bridge every morning and would stop the ride-bound traffic and give the two full lanes for city-bound traffic for periods, and then they would stop that briefly and let a few vehicles trickle from the city toward ride and then two lanes back on city-bound. That was how they had to contend with traffic until the new bridge was opened.
There was a opening swing span, which provided for just one lane of traffic and not very much clearance for the colliers which plied between Newcastle and the Mortlake gasworks. Because the clearance was so small, these colliers always went through against the tide, and this sometimes necessitated them going through at peak hours.
How much clearance would there have been on each side of this, one of those colliers as it passed through the opening span?
I think it was about 6 inches each side.
Brian Pearson is a former DMR's chief engineer, Bridges, and is currently a member of RTA's Heritage Committee. He was the supervising engineer on the Glazewell Bridge project.
The swing span was often hit by the colliers travelling up the river. And the effect of this was that it was very difficult to close the swing span at times. And although it could be closed sufficiently for road traffic to use the bridge, the tram tracks wouldn't line up. So the tramways people got very upset. The road traffic was using the bridge, but the trams couldn't. We had to jack the whole bridge longitudinally to close it the extra few inches to get the tracks lined up.
Local residents had become exasperated by problems encountered with the bridge. One such person was Lynn Joyce, then a Riverside Girls High School student.
It opened sideways to let boats through, and I remember on hot summer's nights, my father would be coming home from working in the city, and they would open the bridge and they wouldn't be able to get it closed again because of the heat making the metal expand. So quite often they used to have to call the little tugboat ferries from the city to come and spray water on the bridge so that the metal would retract and they were able to close the bridge again. And on those particular occasions, Dad would get home at about midnight and we'd all be waiting there very excited for him to come home and tell us the story about the major event that happened at the end of the day.
The DMR had formulated a grand plan for a Sydney road network stretching from the city to Newcastle. Tony Prescott, a professional historian with the New South Wales Heritage Office, was then a Hunters Hill resident.
The road network vision for the city, and it seemed to me to be almost to sort of replace the public transport city with a very car-oriented city. There certainly was a mania for cars in this period. I guess with the growing post-war affluence and that, every family had to have one, and this certainly generated a pressure for road building and an expectation that the roads would be improved to meet the demands of the traffic. It also marks a bit of a watershed in the shape of Sydney, I guess, in that this period post-war marks the transformation of the city from a walking and public transport city in the European style to a North American style motor vehicle based city. There's no question about that. I think that's the sort of broader context. So this creates this powerful demand which structures like the Glaswell Bridge are a product of.
The plan was for a new bridge downstream of the existing Iron Cove Bridge and a new road just east of the existing Victoria Road connecting with Gladesville Bridge, thence via Tarbin Creek and Fig Tree Bridges and up the Lanco Valley to connect with the expressway to Newcastle.
The site chosen for the bridge, there would have been a few criteria. One was the position of the main road leading to the site, wherever it would be, and another is the terrain, and another consideration is how wide the width of the river at the proposed point. In this case, the point chosen, they had a good favourable topography for approach roads because this had to be a very high bridge. The main reason for the new bridge being so high was that it was anticipated that very large ships would be coming up there in the years to come. This didn't eventuate, but huge oil tankers and all manner of heavy, high shipping, and that's the reason for the high clearance. And the topography lent itself to a high bridge.
Phil Hallinan was a maintenance engineer with the DMR. But what sort of an organisation was the DMR at that time?
It was known in some respect as the Department of Mini Relations, as in DMR, but it was a somewhat bureaucratic organisation, a lot bigger and old-fashioned, more in the old public service mould.
I think it was obvious even then that the DMR had a lot of, I'm not sure if a lot of power is the right term, but it was very well placed in the public service in terms of its self-confidence and esteem and so on, and it was certainly the organisation you could get lots of nice glossy literature out of, and they had a lot of self-confidence in that, and their position seemed to be relatively unchallenged. And you could compare that with the railways, who seemed to be constantly under siege and always on the defensive in that. You know, they were in a very strong position, they knew it, and you know, it certainly has been said they were almost a de facto planning authority. They had that much strength. As far as roads are concerned, I don't think the planning authorities sort of really wanted to move into their territory. The DMR did the road planning, and the planning authorities filled in the bits in between, so to speak.
There are stories that back in the days of John Shaw as a commissioner, and even one or two after him, that the minister would come down to his office and sit out and wait until Shaw was ready to see him, which is a bit different to the situation that's probably applied over the last 20 or 30 years. It was an organisation that was very much run along military lines in those days, and a lot of the bosses at the time had wartime experience and had served in construction regiments. The structure was military in that we had divisions and various officers at officer level. There were certain efficiencies, I think, from that process as well, in terms of mobilising numbers of men to do work at the field level and having a chain of command where you could react quickly to emergencies. And to have, it was also a very engineering-oriented organisation, and as such, the engineers, and they get criticised for wanting to build expensive, grand things, and there was possibly an element of that, but by and large, they're very much frustrated if they can't make things happen. They didn't want to spend too much time planning and thinking about what might happen. They wanted to make it happen.
In those sort of civil engineering areas particularly, the engineer was king. I mean, engineers have always had an ascendant role in society, I think, because they tend to inspire with large-scale works, I guess.
Kevin Forrester undertook the structural analysis of the Gladeswell Bridge design. He worked in the bridge section of the DMR.
The fella in charge of the place, he was a chap called Robertson, and he had some of the blokes and girls there. He had them terrified. He used to yell at them, you know. And he used to yell at me sometimes, because I'd worked for the Americans at Cornell, and I was not impressed. I used to just give him my look of dumb insolence. After a while, he'd go away and leave me alone.
In 1957, the DMR produced their design for a new Gladeswell Bridge. But it was not to be.
It was a steel truss form design, a cantilever truss, a fairly elegant design because it was towards the end of the era of that type of bridge. The main designer was Karmalski, who was responsible for the design of the K-truss bridge over the Hawkesbury, the existing Pacific Highway Bridge. All the steel work was underneath the deck, a curved underside. That was a design that was done in-house, and it was really getting towards the end of Karmalski's career. So I think it was some disappointment for the in-house designers that when the DMR called tenders in 1957, worldwide they called tenders for and asked for alternatives, and they got one in the form of a concrete arch, which was really a coming technology. It was a new era in getting long-span concrete arch bridges.
The successful tenderer was a partnership of the English civil engineering construction firm Reed and Malik and the local building firm Stewart Brothers. They called themselves Stewart Brothers and Partner. The actual design was carried out by the English consulting engineers Maunsell and Partners. Guy Maunsell, who was the founder of Maunsell and Partners, was something of a genius, and what his first contribution that I'm aware of was a cluster of forts on pile foundations off the mouth of the Thames on which were mounted anti-aircraft guns. Then, during the D-Day invasion of Normandy, he was responsible for the design of what were called the Mulberry Harbours. These were great concrete boxes that were towed over to France, and then piles were pushed down from these into the ground, what was called spuds. This provided safe harbours for the traffic that came later.
The original arch was of 910 feet span, and that was the tender price of £2.39 million. the design was accepted by the department on the basis of checking results. However, after the contractor was informed that his tender was going to be accepted, Mr. Reed, the principal of the firm, contacted Mr. Shaw, who was the commissioner for main roads at the time, and proposed that the span be increased to 1,000 feet because that length of span would suit the site better. It would take the arch abutments out of the water and place them on the banks of the river, and that would provide the appearance of a bridge springing out of the banks instead of out of the water. Aesthetically, there was a tremendous advantage in increasing the length of the arch. There was another advantage, which was one of prestige only, in that the 1,000-foot arch would then be the longest concrete arch bridge ever constructed in the world.
We're talking late 50s, early 60s, and this was an era in Sydney where we were starting, or around the world, where we were starting to see the development of pre-stressed concrete bridges for medium and longer spans. There was an attraction with pre-stressed concrete in the context of long-term durability, long-term serviceability. There wasn't the need to paint and repaint and to be concerned about durability of steelwork. And with pre-stressed concrete, the section sizes weren't as heavy as you had to have with reinforced concrete. And Frank Cook, who was the chief bridge engineer of the time, he'd been to Europe in about the mid-1950s. He saw that was happening in pre-stressed concrete. And he saw a few other innovations in bridge engineering that he also brought back and convinced the DMR that they should get involved in. But I think he came back with a particular view that he wanted the DMR to get into this modern use of concrete.
How ambitious do you think was the plan to build this bridge? I mean, we hadn't really built a bridge of that size before.
Well, one can't deny that it was ambitious. It was something that no one in the world had tackled before. The design was simple. It was 2,000 years old. That part of it appealed to me. We had some experience with arches, but only on a small scale.
Kevin Forrester's career was given a boost when one day a rather large package landed unexpectedly on his desk.
Robertson came up with a bundle of drawings and he flung them on my desk. He says, "What are you doing?" I said, "Oh, I'm just finishing off this job here." He said, "What is it?" I told him. "Oh, when you finish that, just have a look at this." I gave him my usual look of dumb insolence and he walked off. I never even unrolled these drawings. You know, that was the way I reacted. And about an hour later, I thought, well, I better humour the poor old bugger. I unrolled it. Oh, God, I nearly fell off the chair. It was a 1,000-foot concrete arch. The thing was that the department was understandably concerned about this great enormous bridge that was heading into uncharted waters, and they wanted someone of their own people to have a look at this thing and make sure it was all right. Now, I had a look at it all, and really they hadn't taken account of any sort of deformation stresses, secondary stresses, you know, for this non-linear effect, which as soon as I saw it, I thought, I'm not terribly happy about that. But on the other hand, they're pretty safe in what they did, because they'd organised it so that the shape of the arch was such that the thrust in the arch was fairly central within the arch. You get deformations and the thrust line gets deflected from the centre of the arch, which means that you get a bending. And this is what this non-linear effect is all about. First thing I did, of course, was to dig out as much info as I could about the Sunder Bridge. That was the big Swedish one. I did get a fair amount of stuff. The best source I found was a fellow's PhD thesis, a bloke called Bergström. The only trouble was it was written in Swedish. And so I got a Swedish grammar and I got stuck into Swedish. There's 150 irregular verbs in Swedish, did you know that? Buggers of things. I learned enough Swedish to be able to read this thing, and I did my assessment on that.
Kevin Forrester was the main checker in the bridge section, and the design of the arch was handed out to Professor Roderick at Sydney University, I think Professor Pippard in England, and Eugene Fresenay in France. Each of those experts was asked to comment on the design. However, there was a problem that had occurred of the DMR's own making, and that was the DMR's decision to increase the width of the bridge at the northern or Huntley's Point end from 6 traffic lanes to 10 traffic lanes. And that was a major change to the initial bridge design. New quantities had to be calculated by the contractor for the whole bridge and checked by the DMR, and a new contract price determined, which raised the price of the bridge from the original tender price of £2.39 million to £3.6 million or thereabouts, which in today's figures would be in excess of $100 million.
Was the department horrified by the additional cost?
My feeling at the time of the department's attitude was that we've got a pretty good bargain.
What to you was the most frustrating thing about building this bridge?
The waiting. Considering that the original tender was accepted in 1957, it wasn't until the beginning of 1960 that work started on the site. So we had that intervening 3 years of wait while the design was referred to those experts. University people are very difficult people to get anything out of in a hurry, and we had to be patient and wait until their reports were received. But once the job got started in 1960, it went very rapidly.
As work on the bridge and roadworks commenced, residents were becoming somewhat uneasy about the effect on their suburbs.
To build the bridges, they had to take away a block's width of land right across the peninsula, and there were conspicuous buildings affected by that, namely the tea rooms, St Marlowe, Mary Reby's cottage, and the Fig Tree Chapel up at the top of the ridge, the Bank of New South Wales, which is a quite a nice two-storey building on the other side, the police station, and a number of homes, of course. I know there was a lot of debate going on with the Minister, Pat Hills, as to whether it had to happen this way and whether St Marlowe could be saved by deviating around it and so on. And when you look at the siting of St Marlowe and the way that they've approached some of those roadworks in more recent times, in retrospect, it's probably quite possible that they could have saved some of those buildings. But in those days, I think they seemed to approach everything on a very grand American scale, and there was no other way of doing it.
One of the buildings affected was Fig Tree Chapel.
But Fig Tree Chapel was a sort of early Anglican church. It was obviously caught up in this area where the buildings needed to be demolished for the road. It was on the corner of Church Street and Dubert Street. And the DMR agreed to fund its sort of dismantling and re-erection. And I remember this was done, and it was re-erected on a site nearby, and I think it became known as St Mark's, and I think they made some little improvements when they put it back up again. So I guess that was probably the government's gesture to keeping some of the heritage. Probably could have done that with St Marlowe rather than the little chapel, but anyway, that was one of the outcomes of it, I guess. The only sort of heritage outcome on the physical front, I mean, the wider outcome would have been the interest in heritage and the heritage movement that was really prompted by the events there.
Local resident Chris Hanrahan was enthusiastic about the prospect of a new bridge.
Yeah, I remember them clearing the land. I do remember there was quite a bit of bush there on the headland, and they were clearing that for quite some time. That was the first visible change in the area. But it was never a negative thing. I mean, it was never, nobody ever regarded that it was going to be an imposition. It was always welcomed because we needed it so badly. I mean, we needed the flow of traffic, and we needed, all of this area was opening up. And it was, a lot of it was originally market gardens and dairy farms, and it was opening up as residential, and there was a great cry for a better form of transport to this part of Sydney.
People were more accepting that the government knew what it was doing, and if they said that was the way to do things, and that people tended to accept that. Certainly the notion of environmental studies and impact statements, that wouldn't have been even dreamt of at the time.
One of the more colourful characters who worked as a labourer and dogman on the Glaswell Bridge was Ozzie Cruz. He's now a councillor with the New South Wales Aboriginal Lands Council.
I first became involved with the Gladesville Bridge in its very infant stages when Bradshaws were doing the excavation. And I lobbed the job there because I was a heavy plant operator, and I used to be able to work with the hard rock drillers. And so I started off as a jackhammer worker, and we were cutting the foundation. And our old boss, he was a pretty careful old guy, and he liked to see his jobs done neat, so he wouldn't let you waver about an inch one way or the other. So we had to plumb bob our cutting all the way down. And when you'd cut down, when we used to cut down into the sandstone a certain depth, you know, say 10 foot, they'd set the charges and they'd blow that piece out. So that was the way that we went down through this massive foundation. When we got down a certain depth, we were starting to get down below the water level. Well, the engineers had to put a steel levee around, and that levee held the Parramatta River back. And we went down, must have been about 22 foot below that, into the solid rock. So it was incredible. Even the foundation itself was incredible. When we finished the foundations, we started to fill it up again. It was a crazy thing. We cut it out, and then we started to fill it up again with concrete and steel. So I started working there with the concreters. And then I decided, I wanted to have a bit of walkabout. I decided we'd go and do some season work. So we left the city and went away into the country for a while.
Bridge builders of that era, they work hard and they play hard. They move from bridge to bridge. They were generally men, the higher level ones, who had involvement in bridge construction and bridge maintenance, sometimes with the contractor, sometimes with the DMR. They had to be able to understand bridge plans, line drawings on paper, which represented concrete and reinforcement and steel, and what that meant in real life. And smart contractors tended to make sure they didn't get offside with our superintendent. It's not from the point of view that they'd be too hard on them, but from the point of view that they could always learn a lot. Our superintendents had a lot of experience, and a smart contractor was very wise to tap into that experience.
The workforce was large and varied. Bill Davis, who worked on the bridge, recalls some of the more interesting characters.
At one stage there, we had a father and two sons who had been dunny carters. So I think it was Riverston they came from, and they decided to have a change and come and work on the bridge. Oh, God. And whenever they'd carry drums, they'd carry them on their shoulder like they used to do the toilet can. They'd throw them onto their shoulder and they'd rush around. And the stories they told were enough to entertain anybody about their days. They stayed there for quite a while. They were good. They were all good, very good workers.
The labour force was multinational, and many new migrants brought their skills to the project.
In those days, for some reason, every Maltese that came out here was a carpenter. So we had a few Maltese carpenters, some Italians, a whole cross-section. No, they were all okay, good.
Yeah, there were a lot of Cruz work there. My brother Ben Cruz, he worked there. And Freddie Beale was another guy. Freddie was an incredible concrete finisher. He could make that concrete look like glass. But with that, there was a tremendous mateship, you know, with men working together. We all looked after each other.
Who was the most notable character on the site?
I can't think of his last name, but they had stiff leg cranes on either side of the bridge, and they used to call him Donkey. He was in his 70s then, and he used to live in the crane, until they stopped him doing it. He wouldn't go home. He just lived there, had his stove, all that sort of thing.
Joe Ward, now an artist, was then a foreman on the Gladesville Bridge project.
Joey Noble, he was the nipper. We used to give him the lunch money to go and buy the sandwiches and one thing and another. But he was a bit of a plonky too. And he went up to get the lunches and they had all this money and he finished up in the plonk shop and got pretty drunk. And they're all waiting for their lunch and come back about 2:30. On his way back, he said, geez, I forgot the lunches. So he went into a shop and bought a cooked chicken. And when he got back to the job, he'd eaten half of it. He threw it on the table. He said, here, split this up amongst your team of grubs.
Brian Cox was chief surveyor during the construction of the bridge.
When I first saw it, I saw the plans, I couldn't comprehend it at all. A concrete arch using falsework, and well, of course that's the only way they could have done it. But it was something that I had to sort of prepare myself for. And not being an engineer, but being a reasonable surveyor, all I had to do was sharpen up on engineering side of it.
We had to use what at that time were conventional survey methods. The site had been triangulated prior to construction, which is a means of survey by angles without direct measurement. But once abutments had been established, you knew you had an accurate base on which to commence from each side. This was all done with steel band. There was no electronic equipment whatever in those days. Today there's EDM, electronic distance measuring. There are some very sophisticated instruments around today, which would have made the task enormously easier. And also there are things like digi-levels, which are stars with barcodes on, which electronically read automatically. None of that was available. And similarly, there were no electronic computers available. Every calculation for Gladesville Bridge was done on a Brunsviga, that is a Swedish coffee grinder type calculator. And it was all extremely tedious by coffee grinder.
Was it electric?
No.
A handle?
Yes. Turn the handle.
Noisy?
Yes.
I guess it belonged to a museum now, would it? Or?
Yes, the museum items now. All the survey equipment used on that project would be considered museum material now. But nevertheless, the results obtained would be every bit as good as what you would get today with the electronic equipment.
Pile driving was in progress when I arrived on the job, and the contractor employed a subcontractor, Sydney Bridge and Wharf, but the contractor actually designed a rig for him to drive the piles. And this was a very special rig which allowed the head of the pile to be moved fore and aft, right or left, so that the machine could shape up to a pile cap and drive the four piles, which were raking in four different directions. It was quite notable sitting in the office and just listening to the constant hammer of the pile driver. And you could tell as soon as the pile hit rock with the change in the note of the hammer.
And how deep did those piles have to be actually driven?
They varied, but a lot of them were around about 100 feet. But there was a fault in the rock, and three of the piles went into this fault and went much deeper. The deepest of those went to 160 feet. I suppose one of the more unusual features of the construction of the bridge was the extent to which the contractor used the Titan floating crane. Now, that crane had originally been brought from England, or it was probably Scotland, for the construction of the harbour bridge.
That's the thing that was owned by Cockatoo Dock. It was a steam-driven thing. It had to be towed around on a big barge. I think it had 150 tonnes, I think, it could lift.
Well, the dogman those days used to work with a crane driver. The dogman is the one that used to hook the loads up to the end of the cables, and used to ride the loads or ride the sling, what we call ride the sling. You'd sit in the sling, you'd make sure your eels were hooked into the bottom and your backside was comfortable in the sling, and you'd sit in it and you'd ride the sling from any height. You know, sometimes you'd be 120 foot up in the air. The communications weren't like they are now with radio and things, because you had a whistle and you had to be in the view of the crane driver. So sitting on the load was the best place you'd ever view, and you'd be able to signal with your hands where you wanted to load. And because there was a lot of obstruction in between, the dogman couldn't walk backward and forward. He had to ride over the tops of people, and you'd had to sit on the load or stand on the load and ride it over to wherever you wanted it, and you could put it down a lot quicker. Those days were really wonderful days. I can remember the time that somebody got into the ear, old Slim, the crane driver. It was a rainy day and we had never had a lot to do. And so Slim asked me to do a job over the other side of the yard, and I jumped in the sling and I'm riding the sling over. And I wondered why he's going out over the water. And he put the jib out as far as it'd go in the Parramatta River, and then he started to lower it towards the river. And I'm thinking, now what's this silly old coot doing? Because they never told me that what he does with new dogmen is give them a dunk in the river. And so I'm going down and I started blowing the whistle to stop. And old Slim didn't hear me. He didn't want to hear me. So he put me in the river. I had all his regalia and all the wet weather gear, gumboots and all. And down I went into the water, right under the water too, in the sling. And I stayed in the sling though. And when he pulled me up, I was shaking my fist at him and he was laughing like mad.
One of my jobs was to precisely level right across the steel falsework from Huntley's Point to Drummoyne with a precise level and parallel plate micrometer, which was quite difficult on account of two things in particular, or three things. One was you had extremely short foresights going up the arch. Another thing was if there was much wind, you had to be very patient in taking your readings. And another matter was that the steel falsework was most of the time shaking because of many workers going about their activities on it.
The arch tapered from the abutment or springing to the crown, so that each of the arch blocks between those two points was somewhat different in shape from the block either side of it. So at Woolwich, the contractor established a casting yard with enough foundations to cast all of the blocks for one rib of the arch without moving any of them. These were cast as four vertical walls and in due course were taken to the site, turned over and erected in the arch.
The hollow blocks were brought up by a barge and lifted up and transported on a trolley across onto the steel falsework and then just lowered down either side. And as they came against each other, they had hardwood packs that kept about a 4-inch joint. And then they were concreted afterwards. And then the packs taken out and they concreted around, so that was a solid joint. Every fifth block was a solid with an oval hole through it, access hole, diaphragms. And they just did the one single arch, jacked it, and then moved the falsework sideways. And they pulled the falsework out on skids, on rails, skidding across on top of the piles and ready for the next arch. And as they put each arch, they got the four arches, they then joined them with the cables and stressed them together and then concreted them as well. So you had the arch, and then all the road beams were built either side of the bridge on site. They put all these on, stressed them on with big bars, and put the top parts on, and yeah, it was straightforward once you knew what was happening.
The ribs were being erected on a steel falsework, and the units accumulated a huge tonnage as they were progressively placed from the bottom up towards the top, one side, one the other. I think there are 128 units in each rib. Huge tonnage of concrete, so there was quite a bit of deflection of the steel falsework. And of course, as the units were placed on the falsework, hardwood blocks of varying thicknesses had to be placed underneath them, as it were, to shim them onto the cords of the falsework so that their underside profile would come out as planned. That was quite a task to get these shims correct, and the more units you put on, the more deflection of the steel falsework occurred.
The Gladeswell Bridge project was large enough to enable a special concrete testing lab to be set up on the site.
It was unusual to have a lab on the site in those days, and for a number of years after, all the concrete cylinders, and that was the main interest for the lab, were forwarded to our testing laboratory, which is at Milsons Point under the approaches to the Harbour Bridge. And we had a test laboratory there that covered both concrete and soils and bitumens. But Gladeswell was a big enough project, and there was a need for a turnaround of results too for the precast box units we used to make up the arch ribs. But the main purpose of the lab would have been to test concrete cylinders, which were samples of the concrete that was used in the ribs and other parts of the structure, cast into moulds. I think they were 6 inches diameter and 12 inches long, and they were tested in a testing machine to determine the load at which they broke. And whilst tests would be done at early ages, say 3 days, 7 days, 14 days, for the purposes of allowing production to proceed, the result that was paid on was the standard result is the 28-day tests. So the concrete testing was used to investigate particular batches of concrete, but it was also used in a bigger picture sense to manage the quality of the concrete. So results generally were analysed over time to determine whether there were longer-term trends of a drop-off in the strength of concrete.
The concrete in the precast products of the bridge was required to have a minimum compressive strength at 28 days of 6,000 pounds per square inch, which involved a target strength 20% higher of 7,200 pounds per square inch. In those days, these were very high strengths indeed. In fact, I cannot recall that such a high strength was required in a bridge until that time.
Alan Leask was a research and materials engineer for the DMR. His job on the Gladeswell Bridge was to test the strength of concrete in the specially constructed fog room.
It's a room which has artificially produced fog, which means 100% humidity, and with a temperature controlled to 70 degrees Fahrenheit plus or minus 1 or 2 degrees.
So how many tests would you have done, say, on the arch rib concrete boxes during the construction period of those?
Oh, well, there were about 1,000 tests done on those.
Right, and what percentage would fail the test, do you think?
None.
Not one single one failed?
No, not one.
Is that usual or unusual?
It's not usual, but it's a tribute to the quality control that was exercised on this job.
However, it seems one of the concrete box units, after having been placed on the falsework, did appear to fail the test.
One of the blocks failed to reach the minimum 28-day compression strength in the cylinder tests. Of course, by that time, by the time you test a cylinder at 28 days, the product's well and truly made and is curing. But we had an apparatus in the bridge section called the Smith Hammer. It was an invention of the Swiss. It was rarely used, but it was an impact type of hammer, so that as the impact from hitting the concrete was recorded, it registered on a gauge. And an experienced user of the equipment could tell from the registration what strength the concrete was. So Cliff Robertson came out with the instrument one day and went round the concrete block and got the lowest registration, marked the spot with an X, and said, "That is your weakest concrete." So a core was taken at the spot marked X, and it turned out to be about the highest strength of concrete we tested. So the block was used in the bridge.
It was left in situ, was it?
We never saw the Smith Hammer on the site again.
Was the Smith Hammer totally discredited after that?
Either that or the user.
We had a problem or two with what we call honeycomb factor in the concrete. That's when poor compaction might occur in an area and you get this effect of honeycomb porosity in the concrete. And that occurred in one of the blocks and may have been in two or three. So we agreed that in those areas where honeycomb had occurred, the porous concrete would be cut out and replaced with epoxy concrete. That was done, and done in a tradesmanlike fashion, and the blocks were accepted for incorporation in the ribs.
Gladeswell Bridge was all post-tensioned. It was mainly the beams and the columns that were post-tensioned. The arch was not, it was just a gravity arch. There were cables put in at a later date, but they were a bit of a joke act. I thought they were just a sort of a face saver. I didn't think they did much good.
Did it make people feel better?
Made everybody feel better, yes.
4 miles to the west of Sydney Harbour Bridge, a great six-lane concrete bridge, 1,900 feet long, is being built by the Department of Main Roads over the Parramatta River. It will replace a narrow 80-year-old steel bridge. The arch of the new bridge, with its clear span of 1,000 feet, is the longest concrete arch yet constructed in the world.
To record the construction of this major bridge project, the DMR commissioned the making of a film. The company chosen was Kingcroft Productions, headed by John Kingsford Smith. The cameraman was Peter Menzies.
John Kingsford Smith was a nephew of Sir Charles Kingsford Smith. He was a bit of an adventurer himself. He did a lot of stunt flying. I saw pictures of him flying under the Harbour Bridge, standing on the wing of a tiger moth. And he also set the Australian record for the highest altitude in a light aircraft. I was assigned the role of cameraman. As a junior cameraman, I was pretty proud of that too, to film a record on a regular basis of what was happening on the construction site. My brief was pretty simple. From John Kingsford Smith, it was to, you now have a regular job acting as cameraman on the construction of the Gladeswell Bridge until it's completed. It really impressed me as a project. It was huge. And it unfolded during the course of the filming of the bridge construction, how big it was. Even though I had filmed the pouring of the concrete components downstream on another site, and they would ship them up by barge to be put into place, they didn't really appear to be that big on the ground. But when they arrived on the site on a barge, pushed along by a tugboat, and then people had to be assembled to get them off the boat and haul them up to construction and place them. It was only then as you realise how big the project was, and this was just one small element of the whole bridge construction, and there were so many more to come.
Menzies found that climbing over the bridge with a camera in one hand was proving to be a daunting task.
I was consciously aware of danger once. On top of the bridge, there was another structure, a small office, and access to that office was across a walkway. Basically, it was a couple of planks, maybe 30 feet long. On one occasion, I did find it quite daunting as a task to walk from the safety of the bridge itself out across the water to this set of stairs going up to this office. And I think that even they had two levels and very minimal support rails. And I had my camera with me. So I had it in one hand with it on a carry strap. But in effect, it was like a mad dash across a plank to the safety of the other side where the stairway was. It did appear to be quite dangerous until you started filming. And then when one starts working with the camera, one tends to switch off the concerns, because you're focusing your attention on what you're photographing rather than your own personal fears.
Didn't have any fear of heights. In fact, I used to love heights. Lots of us used to walk across a piece of steel 4 or 6 inches wide, and you'd be up 120, 150 foot in the air, and just walk across it. But you weren't reckless. You knew your limitations. You knew if it was windy, you didn't take risks like that. But
what sort of safety measures were put in place for workers and engineers?
None that I'm aware of. There was no safety footwear. There were no safety vests. There were no hard hats. I can't recall any safety measures at all as far as the surveyor was concerned. He would walk on practically any part of the partially built structure without any safety harness or the like, nothing whatever. That's how things were in those times.
When I first started, people were wearing thongs, a lot of them, including me, walking around in thongs and with picks and shovels and walking over reinforcing and stuff with thongs. And finally, Jack Bryant, who was the supervisor at the time, he issued an order that no one was to wear thongs anymore.
Slim and I, we used to break all the rules of safety. There's a new organisation they call now, Work Cover. Well, we didn't have any work cover those days. And Slim and I, we made it up in our minds that, you know, we'd gain a hour in the end of the day if we free fell the bucket. And I used to ride the kibble bucket and we'd free fall it from the top. That means you threw everything out, and the bucket would just fall. And you'd ride it down and in about 20 foot from the ground, you'd catch it again. And we'd ride it to the ground and fill up the concrete and full bore up again. So we were like this all day, up and down. And so we'd pick up nearly an hour in the evening so we could have a bit of a break. So crazy people, but that was the way that we used to work those days.
Steel-toed boots weren't insisted upon those days. I think everybody on construction sites has got to wear steel-toed boots today.
In the early stages, then when we were cutting the foundation, unknown to my boss, I used to come on the job a little bit under the weather with grog. Me and my mate, we both drank a little bit those days. That was before I became a Christian, of course. And then one day I was cutting with the jackhammer. We were breaking up these big rocks, and the rules are you never use a sharp point jackhammer. When the point sharpens, you change the point. Well, I didn't. I wanted to get this job done and get it over with. And the jackhammer jumped around and jumped off the rock I was cut and went straight through me gumboots into me foot. And when I jerked it out, the blood just squirted up through me boot. And me mate, I think he got a bigger fright than I did. He started screaming out for everybody there to get the ambulance and get the ambulance. When I pulled the boot off, it was lucky it just went between me toes and pinned me foot to the ground, because when it jabbed into me foot, instead of me stop the trigger, I pressed the trigger harder. Pinned it to the ground. But since that, after that, I became a Christian and I gave up drinking. Never drank again since that day.
Underneath where the jacks were, under the arch, it's all covered by a big covering section of concrete now. Like they've glued these slabs on. You can see them when you go under the bridge. And to do it, they had a big scaffold. It weighed about 10 tonnes, this thing. It was a big steel RSJs and timbered and scaffold pipes so they didn't fall off and that sort of thing. It was all hauled up by two cranes and it was secured by stressing cables then. But each cable was only taking a tiny bit of weight, actually, so the things weren't really secure. They thought they were, but they were not. The grips hadn't actually grabbed into the cable sufficiently. Anyhow, they were all working on it. It was lunchtime, I was on top of the arch, I was heading down. At that time, they were also taking out all the piling where the false work had sat, and they were blowing a lot of it underwater, like charges, and they'd be going off all day, and I'm walking over the arch, and bang, that's terrific. I thought, God, they made a mess of that one. And what it was the scaffold, and underneath the scaffold was this big punt, which had brought the scaffold up, this big, great big wooden punt. The whole thing, down she went. Because it sunk the barge, and fortunately the last man had just got off. Had they all been on it, then they'd all been killed.
I was injured myself a few times. Once I broke the rules in relation to settling a sling load of steel down on a skids. And when you're working as a dogman, you don't touch steel with your hand. You never touch it. You'll hang on to the rope and pull the rope around. And I was standing on the end, and I had my hand on the steel, pushing it over and to line it up, and the crane driver dropped it a little bit quicker than I expected, and the steel hit the skids and pulled my hand into it. And when I finally looked at my fingers, four of my fingers were hanging off. And if a man ever screamed, it was the way I screamed, from the pain that was in those fingers. But I thought he'd get a bit of money out of it, but the doctors were so good, they sewed the finger that was hanging down and sewed it back on again. And so I never got any compo out of it, other than 8 weeks in hospital, paid me hospital bill.
One of the diaphragms for the arch rib fell over on top of the false work. And in the process of transferring the diaphragm from one trolley to the other, somebody neglected something and it fell over. You can imagine the noise that came from a 50-ton hammer striking a 1,000-ton steel anvil. It was quite a shock.
It was a Saturday morning, I remember, and I was getting changed. And they were already lifting the diaphragm up. They had an early start. And the diaphragms, unlike the blocks, which were quite big, bulky things and couldn't fall over, the diaphragms were only about 2 feet thick, and they were about 15 or 18 feet in height. And when they lifted them up, they were put on a trolley, and they had props bolted onto them, and they didn't put the props on. They just didn't move it very far. They thought, oh, I won't worry about that. And, of course, the jerk of the trolley moving, the thing toppled over, slammed down flat. It was lucky it didn't go all the way. It hit and tore some of the RSJ. The flanges tore them away from the metal. And anyhow, there it was, perched on top of the arch. So it had to be broken up.
This was quite a setback to the contractor, because you had this very strong concrete, heavily reinforced, and there it was, wrecked up on top of the falsework. Using jackhammers, it had to be broken up into pieces the size of your hand. And I forget just how long it took. It was at least a week it took him to get rid of it.
There was a tanker coming up the river, and it was going to pass under the bridge, and it pranged into the falsework.
I just knocked off, actually. I missed it. I'd been working back, and it came out. It was dusk, and I think the captain had a few grogs, and the thing got way off course. And how it got that far off, I don't know. The navigation span that was in there was quite big as far as width, and it crashed in there. It was lucky it didn't do more damage. It buckled a few things, and that was it.
There was a person not attached with the job itself. He wasn't an employee or anything. It was a person that wandered onto the site there, and I think he may have been under the influence, and fell off one of the heights on the northern side, and done some damage to himself, and I think he passed away in hospital. And that was the only casualty that I know of, other than the guy that was running for either knock-off time or lunch. He was a new Australian guy, and he couldn't stop. And he really smashed himself up badly. I don't know what happened to him, whether he died or what happened there.
I walked from the top off the bridge through the tunnel to the shore on one occasion. Maybe I thought I was taking a shortcut. And I also wanted to experience what it was like inside there. It was quite dark. There was a bit of scattered light coming in from various areas where there were holes that were yet to be filled by concrete, or gaps. I remember looking out through a gap between the concrete blocks, let's say about halfway down the slope, walking back down inside this tunnel. And I couldn't believe what I saw. When I looked out and found the horizon was at almost 45 degrees, it really threw me. It was really a weird feeling. But I had become totally disoriented. Relative to that horizon, I had nothing to measure it by.
We had visitors during construction going through the ribs, and they'd fall over. Pretty well every visitor tumbled over.
This arch was what we call jacked. Now, you got a problem in any arch bridge where you don't just put it up just in one hit and put all the superstructure on, just Mandrake flicking his fingers at it and everything just falls into place. I mean, first of all, you put the arch up, then you put the superstructure on. Now, from Roman times, they did it the same way right up until 20th century, I should say, where you had the falsework, which you put up first. The shape of the top of the falsework was the shape of the underneath of the arch, and you lay your arch on that. The Romans, of course, used dirty big blocks of stone, Then we used cast-in-place concrete. There's no reason why you shouldn't use independent blocks of concrete. But you lay these things on the falsework. Your problem then is, how do you get the falsework out from under the arch? Because the arch is just lying on it. It's not doing anything except just lying there. And it's compressing the falsework. And it's under considerable stress. Now, the Roman system was to have the falsework sitting on opposing wedges. And when your arch was in place, all you did was pull your wedges out, and the whole of the falsework would drop, and it would leave the arch standing. Now, you can understand that after you go to a certain span, it's pretty dangerous to start pulling out wedges. Now, back in about 1920, there was a fellow called Freycinet, Eugène Freycinet. He was a French engineer. Actually, he was credited pretty much with the invention of prestressed concrete. If he didn't invent it, he had a lot to do with its early stages. And Freycinet got the idea that instead of pulling out wedges and praying that the thing wouldn't collapse, you're better to put the arch on the falsework, but allow at the crown a gap, and you put jacks on it. Then you just expand the jacks to push that gap apart.
The jack is, they don't use them much these days, but they were a French thing, a Freycinet invention, and they were two pieces of metal plate stamped out that looked like a dish and then joined with the weld all the way around. So you pick one up, it was just had a tubular outside because of the shape of the thing, welded around together in two halves, and an inlet and an outlet. And they could only move about a bit over an inch or so. That was their maximum, because the metal just expanded around the weld, and that was enough to lift the arch when you had three banks of jacks. You'd do one bank and then the next and then the next, and then there was a spare bank in case they were needed.
What, in effect, was happening was the length of the arch was being increased by this jacking operation. The truss blocks wouldn't move. Now, if you increase the length of the arch, the only way the extra length can be accommodated is by the arch rising. And in rising, it freed itself from the falsework.
Now, did you know exactly how much the arch was going to rise?
Oh, yes. That was all pre-calculated.
I'm always very sceptical about calculations. And I used to think, what they've done, they've put those concrete blocks and they've filled it in with concrete. Now, there are 120-something concrete blocks in an arch, each with about, I think it was 4 inches of space between, which was packed with mortar. Now, you put the blocks on the falsework, you put the mortar in, you let it all harden. While you're doing that, the concrete in the joints is shrinking so little, just a little. You get a hair crack. Each joint has got two hair cracks. You've got 120 of them. Now that you've got to overcome before the arch starts to rise. And I was coming down the train one day. In those days, of course, I was travelling up and down from Glenbrook. And I went past a railway shunting yard near Clyde, and I saw a train shunting, and it was a long goods train, all these trucks, and there's a loco came along and he came up to one end to push it, and he went bash into the first truck. It moved so much, it pushed the next truck, it pushed the next truck, it pushed the next truck, and so along the train, and the last car didn't move. And I thought, that's what's going to happen with the bridge. You're going to push all these little hair cracks. I mean, it's going to add up. I was perspiring when I saw it, because this is what could have happened on the arches. In other words, we wouldn't have had enough jacking expansion. And what do?
This process of expanding these flat jacks and lifting the arch off the falsework was done midnight to dawn, and that was to ensure that everything was at a uniform temperature. Because in the daytime, the sun will be on one side of the bridge or the other, and you can get transverse movement effects. Thinking back now, you'd say it was a quality control process, that the little building they built to control all this jacking, it was actually built on top of the arch. So I guess that concentrated the mind of the people that were engaged in doing the work, that had a good reason to make sure it worked properly. And when they did each of these, they used to take one of the boys, one of the young blokes, out of the bridge section to go out and help, to be the runner and to do whatever had to be done, and also just to have the experience of being involved in such a great job. And I was lucky enough to be there for either the third or the fourth of these events. And the way it was done on the first night, just one bank of jacks at each quarter point was inflated. So the arch was 2 inches longer when we finished on the first night. And all it had done was rise a bit, but it hadn't come off the false work. And a couple of guys later, we came back and we inflated the second. And this was all done with hydraulic jacks pumping into these flat jacks. And the second bank was inflated. So then the arch was 4 inches longer. And by that stage, the arch had lifted off the false work. But during the day, it settled back down. And so we came back a couple of nights later and we inflated the third bank of jacks. And by that stage, the arch was well and truly clear of the false work. And the fourth bank of jacks were there for luck.
They had targets for theodolites sticking out either side of the arch on both sides, and they had people on the shore with theodolites watching any movement as the thing started to lift. And if it was to start to move sideways, they had trimmer jacks in the concrete that could counteract it. And they inflated the first row of jacks and the thing started to rise, and they had engineers scurrying around underneath. Yes, it's lifted up, it's lifted up. They go, oh yes, look at it. They're all impressed. They then had to bleed the oil out of them because there was about 2,500 pounds of pressure in there, and replace it with cement grout. So you'd release the jack, put an air hose on, blow all the oil out, and then put the pressure of grout, which was about 120, 130 pounds. So you're letting out 2,500 pounds, you're putting in 100-odd pounds, and all of a sudden there's this terrific bang. And the pressure, of course, had increased in all the other jacks as they were bleeding off thousands of pounds out of one. The others were taking up the strain, and of course they got higher and higher, and finally one exploded, and they called a halt to proceedings. They then had a big conference, and how they rectified it, they let the oil out, put the grout in, and then they pressurised that grout with an oil line up to the pressure that they'd... So what's inside those jacks now is a mixture of grout, grout and oil. And if you go under the Glazeville Bridge today, you can see all the big stains where the oil has seeped out through the years. It's quite evident when you go under there. Anyhow, that was the way they did the rest of it from there on, so that they could recover. Each time they let one off, they could recover the same pressure, and they didn't have the thing going down and exploding jacks.
Now, had the Fresenet jacks been used in Australia before on any other project?
I can't recall they're being used before, that, but they've been used many times since.
This was pioneering stuff, was it?
Could be so, yes.
The big cables that we pulled through that bridge, massive cables, something like 4 inches in diameter. They're stretched right across the bridge, up through the centre of the bridge. We pulled them by hand and by machine when we can get machines on it or come-alongs. So they were put in there and they were stressed up. And then to check out areas that were already finished, like joins and that, we had to get into these incredible cramped spaces. I can remember myself doing some of that work, and you'd be crawling up underneath the whole concrete decking, and you'd only have about 2 inches above your body, and you hardly take a deep breath because you'd feel yourself cramping in those areas, and you'd have to inspect all these joins and make sure there were no cracks, and if there were anything there that looked a bit fishy, we used to grout it up.
The order of accuracy of construction was probably down to a quarter of an inch. May have even been tighter. Today it would be possible to get down to an eighth of an inch between adjacent surfaces. I don't think you need to get any lower than that. There hasn't been much change since Gladesville days in the compaction of concrete. There has been an increase in the strength. The 6,000 pound per square inch compressive strength was record-breaking for the DMR. But now we're talking about 10,000 pound per square inch, or the metric equivalent. And of course, as your strength increases, your allowable stresses increase, and once again that horrible thing called creep enters into the bargain.
Must be a bridge builder's nightmare creep, is it?
It's not a good thing to have around.
Well, what can you do to minimise creep?
Two things. First of all, we use high-strength concrete, which has got a smaller amount of creep, and we use high-tensile steel, which has got a smaller amount of creep, and that's the way you get over it.
When you start to see it come into place,
you become amazed at the intricate precision of the building itself, of the bridge. We came from both sides of the river, and when we met in the middle, we were only just centimetres out. And it was an incredible feat, you know, of engineering.
I remember standing at Huntley's Point, looking at the ribs, and an old chappie telling me that it looked a bit steep for his car. He only had a 1928 Chev. And no one realised the arch was going to have a deck on top of it.
The bridge was nearing the latter stages of construction as the piers and deck were added to the now completed arch.
The pier designs were precast columns with headstocks linking the tops of the columns, and the system was joined together by high tensile bars that were stressed. We were very familiar with pre-stressed concrete techniques by then. And the deck itself comprised beams of 100 feet length to span between the piers, and they were post-tensioned. They were a T-section.
When we started to see it finished, because I had the privilege then, when all the blocks were in place and all the stuff inside was tightened up, the cables and that, I had the privilege then of standing those side rails and the light posts. I always tell my kids, old Pop stood them lamp posts up there when he was a young fella. I drove this old crane that had three wheels, two in the front and one at the back. And I used to stand those rails and those posts over there, coming over the bridge, because you could see it coming together, and that was the exciting part about it. Of course, I upset the roadman there a few times when they just had the bitumen down, and I decided I'd drive across it with the old crane, and they started cooing at me, but we were the bosses. We were the fellas that built the bridge. They could do that again. But I tell you, it was a wonderful experience for me, because I got a lot of experience and a lot of qualifications that I would have never got.
Particular significance was in the design of the outer railing. There was some concern that Gladesville would become a place for people who wanted to commit suicide to go to. And in fact, it went as high as our commissioner, Jack Shaw, who took a personal interest in getting a railing that was very difficult to climb over. And he engaged some architects to assist him in that. And what they came up with has been very effective. It's a taller railing, it's about 7 or 8 foot high, and it has quite a big tube on the top of it, which is oval shape, and it's very difficult. You can't really get your hand around it to get a grip on it to climb. And the other advantage, which a number of people have spoken to me about, but the fact that you've got this horizontal tube is high enough, when you drive over in a car, the vertical elements of the rail, the vertical members, it virtually becomes invisible, and you drive, particularly as you're coming down, you're coming into the city, you can see the harbour bridge and down the harbour and as though there's nothing there at all. And I think that's a very good result.
How were industrial relations on the Gladesville Bridge project?
There were two unions. It was the AWU and the Builders Labourers. Of course, the Builders Labourers in those days was a very militant union, but there were not many of those. And then the Carpenters Union. And there was a lot of trouble in wet weather. The AWU allowed you, I think, about 2 days or something, a month or whatever it was for wet weather, but the other union, they had a week or something like that, so you'd be out toiling in the rain and all the others would be sitting in the shed with nice and cosy. They did have a bit of trouble with a couple of agitators there at one time, but they sacked them. They were really just stirrers. They called a strike a couple of times and finally they just sacked both of them, and they were very disappointed, but they got rid of them.
When it had rained, there'd be trouble, because we got a policy, having a policy in the BWIU that was no work in the rain, and it was a dangerous job. Just don't work in the rain. And what we did, we were the first ones, I think, to invent the cigarette paper test. Somebody pull out a cigarette paper, and it was agreed, after a lot of argument and everything, if it was too wet to roll a cigarette, it was too wet to work. When it eased up a bit, the rep would go out and pull a cigarette paper out, and if it didn't get wet, we'd go back to work.
The unions made sure that there were good conditions on the job. You know, you got proper wet weather gear, and made sure that you're working in dust a lot. You'd make sure that you had proper apparatus for breathing and things like that.
But I was reluctant union man, let me put it that way.
The road and bridge builders have completed their work, and the new Gladesville Bridge is ready for the special opening ceremony to be performed by Her Royal Highness Princess Marina, Duchess of Kent. Escorted to the dais by the Premier of New South Wales, the Honourable J.B. Renshaw, MLA, Her Royal Highness will declare the bridge open to traffic. Schoolgirls provide a guard of honour.
On Mondays, we always had uniform inspection, and in the week leading up to the bridge opening, when the Riverside girls, the senior girls, had been invited to be on the guard of honour, I think we had an inspection every day, every morning, 9 o'clock. Nails, hair, shoes, everything. Yeah, it was quite amazing. Grooming was very important. And of course, when royalty was coming, well, that was extra, super important. I think we practiced our curtsies for a week before. And our yes mums, no mums, didn't we? I remember we were put through the paces every morning. We were leading up to it. And we were taught how to address Princess Marina if she were to stop and talk to one of us during her inspection of the Guard of Honour.
Another fellow and myself were the first to drive over the bridge, and how that came about, this is long before it was open. Peter Austin, one of the English engineers, he said all along, he said, I want to be the first to drive over this thing. And they were getting the roadway up, and there was a big section, I suppose about 15 feet of nothing there. It's on the top of the arch. And so that they could get the concrete both sides, they brought up a couple of cranes and all these great big massive timbers, and they putting down a temporary bridge so they could drive over. And they were laying these down. I was on the arch. Peter Austin wants to know this. So I scampered down. It was quite a way. Down to the office. I said, look, if you want to be first over the bridge, I said, hop in your car. I said, because they're putting the wood down there for the traffic. He said, get in and come on. And we drove up and we rushed up the... I mean, I had no plan to be first over the bridge, but sitting in the car, and they're glaring at us too, the riggers, and they finally got the thing down. Peter said, out of the road. We drove over, bang. We said, well, we're the first to drive over the bridge.
Through the 60s in particular, and those days, bridge openings, well, even now, they're big events, but they were done differently in the 60s. It was generally a stand built on the site and a ribbon cut. But Frank Cook, he's only complained about these fairly frequent big bridge openings through that period, was that his wife said she needed a new hat every time there was a bridge opening.
I wasn't on the bridge, but I was at the party, and it was a very lavish affair. I think Main Road spent a fortune on that. They took over the Riverside Girls High School grounds. They were pretty bare in those days, a lot of trees there now. And they had the big marquees, and I think there were several thousand people invited.
Visitors await the Premier's introduction of the Princess.
This ceremony marks the completion of yet another phase in the development of communications in New South Wales. But it is also an opportunity for me as Premier of the Mother State of Australia to publicly welcome Your Royal Highness.
Mr. Premier, I would like first to thank you very sincerely for the great kindness with which you have welcomed me. Here in Sydney, I suspect you too have your traffic problems. Sydney is intersected not by one river, but by several, and it is expanding with astonishing speed. It needs to be served by adequate good roads requiring great bridges such as this. I thank you once more for your welcome. And now I have the greatest pleasure in declaring Gladesville Bridge open.
At the time the bridge was built, it was considered to be too large for the site and wouldn't generate the traffic that it could take. Not many years later, I was asked to look at another bridge possibility just upstream of Gladesville. It was felt that if we had that other bridge, we'd relieve the congestion on Gladesville Bridge. And that created a big impression on my mind, just how quickly a new facility does generate traffic.
Into the late 70s, there were benefits seen if an additional lane could be provided for the northbound traffic. So it was decided to minimise the width of the upstream footway and provide an extra lane on the bridge. It wasn't a major modification structurally. The bridge deck had the capacity to take the extra load associated with that extra lane. So it mainly involved demolishing of the existing curb and rebuilding it. I think the footway that was left was only maybe about a foot wide. It was virtually a token one.
We had problems largely associated with our old friend, the creep of concrete. In both land abutments, we noted shortly after the bridge was completed that we were getting cracks, particularly with the abutment on the northern or Huntley's Point side. That's the abutment which is very wide. It's carrying 10 lanes of traffic at that point. I feel that in retrospect it would have been better to have had an expansion joint, in other words a separation of the deck from the abutment, as well as the expansion joints that were designed over piers 4 and 11. And the other point where problems occurred was at the crown of the arch. At that point the deck of the bridge merges with the crown of the arch, and we got a similar effect up there. We got a shortening effect in the deck which tended to cause a fair amount of cracking initially at the junction of the crown of the arch with the deck. That was rectified though with a bit of patching. It wasn't very serious.
One of the big features of building such a big concrete arch is the fact that the concrete in that arch, being under an axial load, shortens over time. It shortens a little bit when the load goes on, but then it continues to shorten over its whole life. And as the arch shortens, of course, it drops a bit and the deck on top drops a bit. So it actually had to be built higher than they finally wanted it and allowed to come down. The research that was done for Gladesville, both in the lab at Gladesville Bridge proper and also the lab at Milsons Point, into creep has been great benefit in establishing methods for predicting creep ever since, for not only bridges in Australia but other forms of concrete in Australia. It was a body of work that was done there that might never have been done if that job hadn't been on.
How long do you think the Gladesville Bridge should last?
Forever.
Is there anything that could bring it down?
If we got a severe enough earthquake, it would be possible, but I can't see anything bringing it down.
In our code, where we go back to the set of rules, the design life that we look to is 100 years. But I believe Gladesville will last longer than that, 200 years plus, I'm sure.
They did do monitoring surveys on it periodically for quite a number of years. My understanding is that at present that's not being carried out. Often the monitoring surveys are discontinued.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing, do you think?
I think it's a good idea to monitor them at a much longer frequency, because I know for a fact that many of the major concrete bridges have certain weak points.
What's the weakness in the Gladesville Bridge, do you think?
Well, I believe that the diaphragms in it have crushed. You see, the units in each rib were hollow. The diaphragms are solid concrete with just a manhole in them, not a huge hole, the same shape as the outside. And for many years, I know these diaphragms were crushing, and the fractures in the concrete were being epoxied to keep the air out. But concrete structures, I don't think, are as permanent as some people might believe.
The RTA checks its bridges, if they're in reasonable condition, every 2 years. For something like Gladesville, which is a big bridge, areas where repairs had been done or where defects had been noticed or distress had been noticed would be checked on an appropriate time frame, 3 months, 6 months. Whereas other parts of the bridge, which were seen to be stable, the two-year cycle would apply.
Now, the Fig Tree Bridge was one of the first of the large bridges to be replaced. The design of the new bridge was of steel girder format, supporting a concrete deck, and the bridge piers were supported by driven piles. In the driving of the piles, we found that the piles initially were pulling up for one of the piers much higher than we thought they should have. So we cored down through the rock and found that the piles were, if we kept driving, we're going to sit on the top of a roof of a cave in the sandstone. So each pile position then had to be bored out so the pile could be driven through the roof of the cave down to the sandstone bedrock of the river. That was the only real difficulty we had with the construction of the bridge.
I remember seeing the opening of the Fig Tree Bridge, which was done by Sir John Cramer, I think. Being a politician, I suppose he had to come up with some joke for the occasion, and he looked at his scissors and he said, a marriage is like a pair of scissors. Sometimes the two halves go in opposite directions, but heaven help anybody who gets in between them. That was the joke for the occasion of the opening of the Fig Tree Bridge, so everybody went ha-ha, and it was opened. Snip.
Tarbin Creek Bridge was an unusual structure. It has a small single arch with tail spans. Its behaviour after it was put into service had some peculiarities, which I monitored by survey some years after it was completed. And also it had some stressing cable problems. Various stressing cables were replaced in it. And as far as I know, it is now a totally stable structure.
If you look at it today, if you ever drive over it, you'll see dips. And the reason that it's a cantilevered construction, where the thing that's holding all that up are stressing cables. The roadway hangs out a long way over the arch, but it's only supported by cables. They're all stressed and grouted in. And then the other part of the roadway sits on that. So at that joint, when you go over that, you'll see a dip where things have relaxed slightly. The cable tension apparently has gone down a bit. And you can see the actual dips in the road.
When you look back on the Glazewell Bridge now, how do you see it?
I see it as part of a triangle of bridges, which the Harbour Bridge and Gladesville and Anzac Bridge, as representing that this issue of having to cross the harbour or inlets to the harbour. And I see the three bridges as representing the state of the art at the time that they were built. The Harbour Bridge was opened in 1932 and Gladesville in 64, so to complete the 32-year cycle, 96 should have been when the Anzac Bridge was opened, but in fact it was December 95.
Well, we should expect another bridge in less than 32 years, do you think?
That'll be 2028. I hope I'm around to see it.
When there's a wind, it's really quite strong on the top of the bridge. When I was quite young, I had a little motor scooter and I was actually blown off my motor scooter. I do remember that. And another incident with the wind was my husband was delivering a lounge from our house over to a family member at Five Dock, and he didn't actually strap it into the trailer. And he was driving over the apex of the bridge, and the fellow who was helping him with this delivery said, Dale, I think you'd better stop and look behind you. And there was the lounge right side up, sitting on the top of the bridge.
There have been some bad accidents on it. Probably a lot of them have been caused by the visibility problems caused by the sharp rise in the bridge, and people come soaring up one side and they don't see what's ahead on the other side of the top of the curve. That's probably a design problem which they must have thought about at the time, but probably couldn't really find a solution for, given the premise that they'd obviously undertaken to span the river in one arch, and therefore it had to rise that high.
The arch, of course, is a significant feature of the bridge, in my view, and also the fact that the roadway rises at a relatively steep grade for a road, and so the road, in some measure, parallels the line of the arch, and I believe that is part of its success.
It's unquestionably a future heritage item. It's in the same category as the Harbour Bridge. Very important engineering landmark, and also performing a function in the development of Sydney and telling a story about the way Sydney evolved in the 60s and 70s, and maybe about the mistakes that were made in the planning and things like this. You know, it's part of that.
You think they'll ever build another bridge that looks like Gladesville Bridge again in Australia?
Would be very difficult to find a site that required a bridge which would be satisfied by an arch.
This may be the last arch bridge, you think?
It could be the last arch bridge in Australia, yes.
That makes it very special, don't you?
It does.
I think everyone that worked on the bridge just didn't treat it as a job. They put their heart and soul into it, and there were some really good tradesmen there and, you know, workers that made a good finished product. They wanted to see it because they knew they were building something special.
I was extremely pleased that I was able to work on it. As far as I'm concerned, it was probably the most interesting project of my career, the most interesting structure to be involved with.
It was a real milestone in my life. It was quite revolutionary for me. Actually, my daughter's the one she's got the backwash of it. She was driving over it with some friends one time, and they were remarking what a fantastic bridge it was, and she said, "My dad worked on this." They were very impressed. One of the blokes, I think he's an electrical engineer, says, "Your dad's a legend."
It stands out, and even today you drive over it, you think, I did that, I played a part in the thing.
And what was the downside for you for working on the bridge?
I couldn't think of any. I enjoyed every day of it.
Yeah, I feel, I've mixed feelings because it's a part of your life. The people you've mixed with there, you wonder where they are, and you see it as a beautiful thing, because I've had probably opportunities that people very rarely have. I've had opportunity to travel the whole world and look at other structures and things that have happened in other countries. And in fact, I was driving across America once, and I come to this jolly bridge, and I said, "This looks something like the old Gladesville Bridge, way over there in America." And I pulled up and took photos of it and had a look at it, and I think now, it sort of brought back memories of the way that the bridges was constructed, the technology of the times. Yeah, no, it's a special bridge. And it was then, and it still is, and it will be in the future.
Oh, I still think it's beautiful. During the construction, I took a lot of still photographs myself. My favourite place to take a photograph was from the wharf at the bottom of Ferry Street to Hunter's Hill. Yeah, sometimes when I'm in Hunter's Hill, I slip down there for a nostalgic look.
How do you feel about the fact that there'll never be another Gladesville Bridge or a bridge like it built anywhere in Australia?
It's probably a good thing, because it'd lose its impact if you had 100 of them.
And now, as traffic flows smoothly and rapidly over the bridge, as if in newly found freedom, we come to the end of the story of the construction of the bridge with the longest concrete arch span in the world. It is also the story of the beginning of Sydney's Northwestern Expressway, which will stretch ultimately from the city to Wirunga and join up with the expressway now being built north of the Hawkesbury River towards Newcastle.
This oral history project was produced by CineTel Productions. Frank Hymans and Martha and Sarah conducted research and interviews. The opinions in the oral history interview tapes are those of the individuals concerned and do not necessarily represent in whole or in part the position of the New South Wales Roads and Traffic Authority.